All right, Monday night edition of the Dunk Time Basketball Podcast. Three great playoff games to talk about tonight, brought to you today by our friends at MeUndies, a new sponsor, and also Vistaprint as well. So, Danny, let's start with OKC and Dallas. We caught up on this one on film after we got back from the Golden State-Houston game. I feel like we haven't talked about this one at all yet, but I might want to try to correct maybe some misconceptions about this one, because, you know, Durant had, you know, statistically an epically terrible game, but I don't know that he and then people were really killing Billy Donovan on Twitter too. But to me, actually, the biggest go to this game was Russell Westbrook, because his defense down the end of the game was so terrible.
Well, yeah, I mean, you saw what Dallas was doing, and they were point guard driven, Felton, Deron Williams. And also along those lines, like, usually when you see a guy has a really bad shooting night, sometimes you see things that are non-representative. Like, they took worse shots. When I did the film study, I guess you could call it, on DeRozan, you know, the shots that he was taking, while he is a bad shot taker and a bad shot maker, were that. With Durant, you know, there were some, of course, that weren't great, but I didn't see it that way. So that part of it was bad luck, but the Westbrook stuff was more preventable.
Yeah, so it'll be instructive here to kind of go through the end of the game. I mean, Westbrook's defense, I cannot recall seeing a point guard play worse defense in an end-of-game situation when you're theoretically supposed to be locked in. And yeah, their offense could have been a little better, but so it's 78-71 with 6 minutes left. Wes Matthews hit a crazy late-clock fadeaway on Dean Waiters. That's not really anyone's fault. Russ missed a pull-up and pick-and-roll. Cantor had his offensive rebound attempt blocked. And then this is when the run started. So they bring it down. Dirks actually sets a screen on the backcourt on Russ, who doesn't make any attempt to get around it, not in a stance at all. And Ibaka then has to help on Russ's man. Dirk actually beat, after setting the screen on Russ, Dirk Nowitzki, who cannot even run at all, beat Russell Westbrook down the floor. Russ was just on his back, jogging back. Dirk was wide open as he cut to the basket, you know, after Ibaka had to help on his man when he didn't get around the screen. And then Dirk was able to feed Mejri for an easy dunk. The next time down, there was a transition pick and roll that they did again. Raymond Felton, wide open three. Russ, not in a stance at all. I mean, this is what would happen, right, on a lot of these. Felton would dribble it up. Russ would kind of be, you know, standing up straight. And then he would decide to basically start getting into his stance as the pick got there. And a lot of times the pick would be making contact with him while he's standing straight up. He's not even in a defensive stance. Maybe he was exhausted. I don't know what the problem was, but it was so bad. So Felton had a wide open three that he made. KD, you know, was missing some shots. He missed a 15-footer off a pin down. You know, not a terrible shot. Then on the next one, it's a Felton pick and roll with Mejri. It's always Mejri, too. It's not like Dirk on most of these either, you know, where, like, the Felton-Mejri pick and roll is something you should be unable to deal with, even if you do have Dirk out of the three-point line that you have to kind of guard on the weak side. Russ does not get around the pick. And then no communication with Steven Adams. He just decides that he's just going to follow Mejri and they're going to switch, which Adams was unaware of. And then Felton gets another just absolute wide open 17-footer.
Yeah, so you see all these things kind of feed off each other, and that Felton, you know, had a nice game in terms of taking advantage of what was given to him, but you don't have to give that to him. This isn't a situation, as you said, with Mejri, where you have to make these really hard choices.
No, I agree. And Russ, all right, you know, you get screened. Maybe there's a rescreen. You know, no point guard is going to just, you know, stay with his man on a pick and roll all the time. That's why the pick and roll is hard to guard. It's the foundation of every good NBA offense that's not in New York.
You said every good offense.
Every NBA offense, I guess I should say. But on these plays, he's just making no effort, and Felton is just getting wide open shots. You know, at the very least, you want to be able to get over the pick and bother him from behind, or when your big man helps a little bit, enough to give you a chance to get back in front. And Russ just was not. There was just no effort at all. I mean, there were like four more of these plays. On another one, Felton did like a little DHO with Dirk. Russ again was never in a stance. And Russ just got lucky that Felton was blocked by Adams. I mean, you know, if it's Dirk, you know, you have to really bust your butt to get over the screen because your big can't help enough. There's nobody else there. You're basically, you know, if you're not going to give effort, you're giving up a layup. You know, he didn't try to go under. He didn't try to go over. He just ran into the screen standing straight up and then never made any attempt to get back to his man. It was incredible. I just like, I really couldn't believe it. How bad it was. And there really were, like, you know, probably like two more of those plays, even, including the last one, the one that was like the key play of the game, the go ahead layup. Russ wasn't in a stance at all, and there wasn't even a screen. Like, Mejri hadn't even gotten there yet. There's 38 seconds left in the game. You're coming out of a timeout, I believe, and he's just not in a stance. And Felton just does a simple crossover, blows right by him, and scores a great layup over Adams. Poor Stephen Adams just hung out to dry over and over again by Russ. But, like, Russell Westbrook got outplayed by Reuben Felton just because he couldn't even get into a defensive stance on him on probably six or seven straight possessions in down the end of the fourth quarter.
Yeah, it's disturbing to me as somebody who was a UCLA alum and who saw him win Pac-10 Defensive Player of the Year. Like, this is a guy who has that, who has the athleticism. And some of it was effort, some of it was communication. And there are a lot of ways that somebody can be a bad or a disappointing defender. And I think we saw just about all of them, other than a lack of athleticism in that segment for Russ.
So everyone was killing Billy Donovan for the typical stagnant Thunder late game offense. I mean, if you want to kill him, maybe you can kill him, you know, for like not installing more movement back in training camp. You can maybe kill the front office for having only two guys out on the floor in their crunch time lineup that they trust to even like remotely handle the ball at all, Russ and KD. But, you know, I thought that within that context, they weren't running like bad plays. Like, they ran some decent stuff to get guys open. You know, they did have what could have been in a tie game at 81. They ran that same play they ran quite a few times, most notably against the Clippers in the regular season, where they would throw the ball to KD off a pin down, and then Russ would get a flare screen out to the left wing for a three. And Russ was wide open on it, just didn't make it. And, you know, he is like a 29% three-point shooter or whatever. You can question that, especially going for a three when, it, you know, it's a tie game at that point with a guy who's not a great three-point shooter. But, I mean, at least got him an open shot. I mean, did you see anything else down the end to really quibble with when it came to Donovan?
Not really. I mean, I thought that, you know, in the last little bit, their offense wasn't great, but I didn't see anything that was egregious. For me, it was, for off the top of my head, it was more in that, like, kind of 3 minutes to 1 minute left where it never seemed like they did a whole lot of motion, movement, really trying a bunch of stuff. And also sometimes they got into their sets late, but that's something that has been a hallmark for this team since Scott Brooks was there.
Yeah, and there's kind of a lot of institutional knowledge with playing that style there. Usually institutional knowledge can kind of be a good thing, but maybe not in this case. The one thing I would point to, and I said in the preview that they would be smart enough because they like to ISO to go after Dirk, and I don't think they ran a single play involving Ibaka, who Dirk was guarding this entire time down the stretch. And I mean, and Dirk is so bad defensively at this point, just so immobile, that really, you know, any kind of screen for KD, you know, a pick and roll with Ibaka, you know, they just did not try that at all. I mean, a pick and roll with Ibaka and KD and with Steven Adams and the dunker, it was always Adams setting the screen, and, you know, Mejri's no great shakes either. But, I mean, I think trying to pick at Dirk would have been the one thing I could have pointed at that they should have done more in the late game.
One small thing I have to mention, because I don't know if we're going to go possession by possession at the end of this, was that screen that Steven Adams set on Wesley Matthews on one of the last, I think it was the second to last OKC offensive possession.
Yeah, this was after you know, the Felton layup, and I thought Donovan drew up a really nice play, starting KD at the right elbow, gave him a back screen down to the right block, and then he cut across the lane, got another screen from Adams that just obliterated Wes Matthews. I'm sure he flopped at the point when he realized that he couldn't get there, and Mejri did not react on a KD at all, and ended up just a wide open jump shot that could have tied the game down two. Missed it. Adams, great job to get the offensive rebound, throws it back out to KD again, and KD just missed again. I mean, he was, what was he, 7 for 33 with 7 turnovers? Was that his line?
Yes, it was.
And that definitely, and I think he missed the most shots in a playoff game since Michael Jordan. I think it was the game three of the 93 finals. This is off the top of my head, but I think Jordan took like 44 shots in that game. So I'm guessing that's probably the one.
I think so.
But in any event, and that was a triple overtime game too, by the way, that the Bulls ended up losing. But, you know, KD, I think he was shooting his normal shots, basically. You know, maybe only five or six of those shots was I like, okay, this is a bad shot. He's rushing it. You know, this was great defense and he had to take it. I mean, it wasn't like he was getting, you know, anyone was ever setting him up wide open, but I thought it was fine. Like, what did you think?
Yeah, they were most of the ones that I saw both in watching the game live at the end, and I went back and watched I was through the first 15, about the first half, is, you know, a couple of the looks were tougher. They were well contested, but 75% of them were standard Kevin Durant looks. Some of those went in, some of those didn't. And if you're at that high a number and you're as efficient as he is, then you can't really argue with the process. It's just that the results weren't there.
Yeah, I thought Dallas did a nice... I mean, West certainly competed about as well as you can expect. You know,
Anderson, too.
Yeah. We haven't given enough credit to Dallas. I mean, Darren Williams was awesome in the first half of this game before he had to retire from the match with aggravating his sports hernia. But, you know, he was really gritting through it, and I think he was 4-4 in the first quarter to give Dallas a nice lead right away, which I think was really important after the way that they got blown out in the last game. And they played hard. Carlisle went to Zaza Pachulia to start it, but Mejri got some time too. Barea was out, which I think, especially given the type of shape that Barea was in lately with this groin, getting more time for Anderson really helped. And I thought that they shouldn't have started Felton. They should have started Anderson. And Felton obviously did a lot of damage, so maybe that was the wrong call. And just, you know, their defense overall was pretty good. But that said, I mean, KD had five or six of those that just went in and out, you know, and I think Oklahoma City with a normal effort still wins this game. I mean, I thought that the defensive effort, especially down the stretch from Russ, was pretty bad, but I'm not like, oh man, Oklahoma City, you know, Dallas has like found something. I think, you know, Oklahoma City was just missing a lot of their usual shots, and they did a nice job keeping KD off the free throw line. But, you know, aside from that, I wasn't like so impressed with anything Dallas was doing.
Yeah. The only thing with that gives me pause, and it's not in this series, is that they're going to have to play a whole lot better if they're going to try to beat the Spurs. I mean, the Spurs will be, you know, basically having kind of a tune-up or joke matches, if you want to call it that, against Memphis, just because Memphis is so hurt. But they're going to be on defensively, and if Westbrook is giving up seams to Tony Parker, that's going to make it a lot easier for San Antonio to get buckets on them.
Yeah, especially with Aldridge being kind of the stick to him and pick and roll type of guy, to a slightly lesser extent that Dirk is. And I do think Donovan, you know, if you're going to kill Donovan, maybe to say, look, he just hasn't gotten Russ to defend, frankly. I mean, just like that effort at the end. I mean, you can't pull that star out of the game, but you got to get that guy to just give some effort defensively. So yeah, the last couple of plays, Wes Matthews got the rebound, just took it away from Durant after Durant's second missed shot in a row, and sprinted down, made a really tough layup over Steven Adams. I would have, if I were him, I would have just waited to get fouled. I thought that shot over Adams was really tough. I think two free throws probably has a higher expected value, and he gets to kill a little bit more time. But he made it. They were up four. It looked like it was done. And then OKC ran a really nice play, eschewed the quick two, and got a nice three for Durant. And he finally made one with a screen coming up to the top of the key as Russ was running a pick and roll to the right side of the floor. I thought that was some more nice action for them. Got KD open for that three. It was a one-point game. Dallas advanced the ball. They had no timeouts left. And just to put a capper on his amazing defensive performance in the last 5 minutes, they're about to get a five-second call. Russ, there's no screen for Felton. Russ just lets Felton walk in front of him with no screen over the course of like 3 or 4 seconds as the count is going. Just doesn't even move, just kind of lets him go. And then Felton just sprints to the ball and gets it, and they get the ball in bounds. They could have had a five-second violation if Russ had just been in a stance, like actively denying him. You would think if there's anybody in the league one-on-one that could, you know, you would have a great chance physically of denying something. Russ Westbrook on Ray Felton would certainly be about the absolute best matchup you could hope for in that one-on-one situation. And Russ, again, just no effort at all. This is after a timeout. They've advanced the ball. Like, how are you not in a stance giving your absolute maximum effort in a desperate situation with 7 seconds left in the game, down by one? It is just remarkable.
If memory serves, it was actually even worse than that, because I think they had to foul once to get into the bonus. And they almost had the same thing happen again, where they basically had a five-second violation and then just at the last second got a seam. And I think it was Felton both times. Seam there. And so if they hold that for even one of those times, I mean, granted, they might not call a five-second just because sometimes refs do a slow count there, even though, you know, even for the home team, all that kind of stuff. But anyway, Felton gets the free throws. And as it turns out, that wasn't that devastating for Oklahoma City.
Yeah, it actually turned out great for them, because he misses them both. And, you know, everyone's like, oh, Carlisle coached the pants off of Donovan, blah, blah, blah. Like, I mean, I'm not really sure what, like, Rick Carlisle was doing that was so awesome. Like, he was just, you know, they were just running a high pick and roll every time, basically, down the stretch. And Rick really screwed up in a couple of ways. One wasn't necessarily his fault, but one was he left Dirk Nowitzki on the floor, which made no sense at all why you would do that when you're in a must-stop situation.
Paralleling the Rockets' mistake, too.
Yeah, you know OKC is out of timeouts, and they're gonna try and sprint down, especially after Felton missed the first one. You know, either way, there's gonna be a situation there where they're gonna have a chance to tie it. Why you wouldn't get Dirk out of the game there, I have no idea. Dirk, to his credit, did a great job of sprinting back and actually getting into position, but that's kind of outcome-based decision-making. Like, you know, someone like Dwight Powell would have had a much better chance there. But then Wes Matthews decides that he's going to fight really hard to try and get the offensive rebound on the Felton free throw and he's the guy guarding Kevin Durant too, you know, like, and Wes actually gets just pulled down by Ibaka in kind of a smart semi-legal play. And then Ray Felton also, when he missed the free throw, runs forward to try to get the rebound instead of getting back. So those are your two guys guarding Russell Westbrook and Kevin Durant, both going after a free throw offensive rebound against dudes who are like 6'9 and 7 foot and 6'10, like two of the most athletic guys in the league, two of the best rebounders in the league, Ibaka and Adams, and then Durant, maybe the best small rebounding small forward in the league. You have your 6'1 point guard and like your 6'5 shooting guard sprinting to the offensive glass. Just terrible mental error by both those guys. They both were way behind the play. That let Oklahoma City actually get a fast break. KD got the rebound outlet to Russ. Russ, I thought, really had the play for a layup. He dropped it off to KD and said, unselfish play. And Dirk, having been the one guy who sprinted back, actually did a nice job of contesting KD. And Justin Anderson, who had tried to pick off Russ, got up. He's a guy who has a ton of athleticism. He was able to contest KD as well. And then just they were lucky that Russ missed his tip and Adams' tip was just a second too late. And that was it. But really just horrible execution by Dallas on that last play.
Yeah, and even something that kind of surprises me is that if you're in that kind of situation, even if you just slow the guy down a little bit, you know, if everybody gets back, sometimes that can discombobulate an offense. Sometimes that can work against you, especially if you have like Michael Beasley trying to do the contain, which is what happened in the Houston one, which we may end up talking about. But here they just basically gift wrapped a clean look. It just didn't go in.
All right, anything else that you had on this one?
No, I just wanted to make sure that we gave proper appreciation to the Dallas guys, because, you know, as much as Oklahoma City lost this game for some reasons, Dallas played a way better game than I think we ever expected.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and you know, you can chalk it up to they overcame like a pretty rough shooting night. You know, I mean, that was 5 out of 19 on threes. You know, that's not enough threes, you would think. You know, 43% from the field, only 10 out of 19 from the line too for Dallas, and the fact that they're able to defend well enough to win, even with that kind of an effort, they did a little bit better keeping Oklahoma City out the offensive glass, although they ended up giving up 19. A lot of those were kind of tips that didn't really result in a ton. They gave up 19 second chance points, which is not, you know, a complete killer. I think that they did play well, but I don't think this is some like, oh, OKC is like, you know, other than the whole Westbrook effort thing, I didn't think that OKC was just like so horrible. I think KD just missed a lot of shots, and, you know, I think they'll be fine in the series.
If they're healthy, you know, assuming that, I think this was about as much of a worst case scenario as you can think of.
All right, we have a new sponsor, MeUndies. This is, frankly, the most comfortable underwear that I've ever owned. They asked me to sponsor the show, and of course I wanted to actually try out the product before I agreed to do that. They sent it to me, and it really is just a revolution in how comfortable they are. Every pair of MeUndies is made from a sustainably sourced model, which is a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton It also has some stretch to it. It really fits well. Doesn't ride up at all. Just fantastic. Nothing can really describe how good they are. I'm going to stop doing that now because it is a rather personal subject. However, once you try them on, you'll understand why they're called the world's most comfortable underwear. If you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free with no questions asked. They have dozens of styles and plenty of limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. So shipping is free in the U.S. and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. You can get the subscription or a single pair. Get $20 off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/capspace. This is a URL for this one, /capspace. At the website MeUndies.com, 20% off your first order, MeUndies.com/catspace. That lets them know that you came from us. So one team that really did not look like they were fine was Toronto. They came back with a season-saving win over the Pacers. The score there was 98-87. Wasn't actually even that close down the end. Your initial thoughts on this one?
A couple of things. I mean, Lowry played a lot better, which I think was really important. And
yeah, despite poor shooting.
Yeah, yeah. I think his just overall impact was substantially more like what we usually see with Lowry, though, of course, the shooting wasn't there. And something that you talked about at the time and is something that you and I both focus on a lot, the way that Vogel handled particularly Paul George, but the minutes of just kind of their, let's say, their good offensive players was a major problem in this game.
Toronto has a fantastic bench unit that's really been a linchpin of their success all year. Their starting lineup with Scola and Valanciunas on the floor, actually, I don't know how it ended the year, but throughout at least most of the year, they were in the negative, which is remarkable for the starting lineup of a 55-win team. But they would make that all up with Lowry and the bench guys, Patterson, Joseph, oftentimes Terrence Ross, Biombo. That unit was fantastic all year. And so Vogel often countered that by having Monte Ellis, George Hill, and Paul George all off the floor. Particularly egregious in the case of George in the first half because he got two fouls and he sat down, you know, maybe with like, I think at least 6 minutes left in the first quarter. All right, fine. You know, that's maybe you take a guy out, maybe you bring him back later in the first quarter. At the very least, at the start of the second quarter, Vogel did not bring him back. So Paul George played 33 minutes, eight less than he played in game one, although he sat out the last three because it was a blowout. So you're basically, you're punting on 5 or 6 minutes of Paul George here. You want to know how many fouls he finished with in this game? Take a wild guess.
I'm going to say less than three.
That's correct. He finished with two fouls.
Yeah, and what's really bad about that, not only is it playing, you know, an inferior unit when they do that, but unsurprisingly, Indiana got killed in that lineup in the early part of it, and then in the fourth quarter, they went back to the well and got killed again.
Yeah, Ty Lawson, negative 13 in his 13 minutes, most of which were played without any of the other kind of big three. I mean, to me, you got Monte Ellis to be a scorer, a guy who should have the ball in his hand. George Hill, also a guy, I think, underrated with the ball in his hands. He was very good in that role last year as the primary point guard. And then George, also a guy, you know, who can create at least a little bit for you. I mean, this is not a team that's a great offensive team that moves the ball very well. They're not a good passing team, but they have some threats at least. And so why not take George out of the game, play him with those bench guys, and let Ellis and Hill run the show, or at least have Ellis as a guy somewhere you can go to for scoring. I mean, I don't like him and Lawson together, but I think you use George to prop up that bench unit and then hope that Hill and Ellis together with the rest of the starters are enough to keep you going, you know, for 3-4 minutes at the end of the first quarter instead. You know, just really did not work out at all. And those were the chief minutes in which this game was lost for Indiana.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple different theories of Monte Ellis. I mean, what I personally like him for is a second unit creator just because he can do better against slightly inferior guys. Also, the rim protectors are usually less potent on second units, so he can do that. But necessity can be the mother of invention in that. That doesn't mean just because Monte's best at that, that if, for whatever reason, Paul George misses the last half of the first quarter, that, oh no, well, we can't screw up the chemistry of that. That's when you bring in Paul George and you take advantage of the opportunity that has been created by getting him the rest. And that's why a rotation, while it is nice to have some stability and, you know, to have those units that have chemistry with one another, like that Toronto unit that struggled sometimes in the first game but was fantastic in this one. At the same point, your obligation, if you're the coach, especially if you're a team like Indiana, where you have the guy who has arguably been the best player on the court, you have to play them as much as you can, as much as they can basically survive, if they're your path to victory.
For the Raptors, looking at some of these lines in the box scores, you would think they'd be in big, big trouble. We said if Paul George shot the way he did and Lowry and DeRozan shot the way he did, they had no chance. Well, that proved incorrect because they were just as bad at least shooting the ball. Lowry, you mentioned this too. He at least got to the foul line. He was 10 out of 10. He had 8 assists in the first half, so he did have 18 points, but he was still 4-13 from the field, 0-5 from 3. And then DeRozan just continues to press. 5 out of 18 from the field, really had some bad moments and only played 31 minutes. Casey actually left him off the floor through, I think, just about the whole fourth quarter when that Lowry plus bench unit was making the run, and he was right to do so, because the problem with DeRozan, this is a little bit of an aside, is, all right, you know, when you're playing Paul George, sometimes you'll get a screen and you'll have an advantage. And in that case, you can attack. You know, they like to run DeRozan off pin downs, like to have him do a pick and roll. But when he doesn't have the initial advantage, what he'll do against most defenders is, now he's going to dribble around for a while. He's going to try an ISO. He'll put his back to the basket. He kind of work his way in, maybe pump fake, maybe get fouled. That crap's not going to work against Paul George. So what he needs to do is, when he gets the ball, if he doesn't have the initial advantage right away, he has to move it. And that's not something that he did. Things really ground to a halt whenever he touched the ball, and, you know, it didn't look very good. Picking up the slack for them, though, two guys who have both been fantastic in the series, Jonas Valanciunas and Corey Joseph.
Yeah, and I would also add in Patrick Patterson. He did a really nice job. And what one of the weird things about the Raptors is that all three of those guys, whether or not they start, I think nominal starting is a little bit overrated, except in the case of Lee Scola, they should be playing starter minutes. And Patterson played 31. I think that's fine for him. Valanciunas ended up with 30. That's all right for him. But Joseph still only played 24. As much as they have other guys on the perimeter that are nice and that can do things, part of what made those units sing is that they had a secondary creator next to Kyle Lowry, especially one who was prominently guarded by Monte Ellis, who can't do that. So I like the idea of Joseph because he's more fundamentally unselfish, and he's looking and he doesn't fall into those bad habits. So I think that they should use him a little bit more in this series.
Yeah, Terrence Ross played reasonably well, though he still somehow was -8 in the game, two out of four from three in 10 minutes. Jamari Carroll played 20 minutes. The move by Casey was to start him instead of Norman Powell. I was hoping when they said he was starting that he was going to start at the four for Scola. That didn't work out. Carroll, you know, wasn't horrible on George. I mean, but he doesn't have quite the burst defensively. And then offensively, he really looks badly. He's playing like a guy who's hurt with no lift, because when he drives, it's always a floater, or he'll kind of make a pass that's like not quite there yet, where you know he's driving, looking to pass. A lot of times you'll see that from guys coming back from injury. So I think of all the guys who guarded George, I thought that Norman Powell did the best. Really looked pretty good on him the few chances that he got. And I think that George is a guy, although he still had a wonderful game, he had 28 points on 20 shooting possessions. He only had one assist. He had 6 assists in the first game. That was a very underrated aspect of his first game. And so that was important for Toronto to keep him from setting people up. And Indiana as a team only had 13 assists and were 4 out of 20 from three-point range, 2 out of 18 from everyone not named Paul George.
They also gave up 12 offensive rebounds, and you mentioned they had 13 assists. They also had 13 turnovers. So you kind of need to you want to have a better assist turnover ratio, but you definitely also want more assists.
Yeah, and they also had 6 offensive rebounds, which is not really very much for this team either.
Especially when you miss 16 threes.
And only 3 block shots. So a lot of the things that worked for them in game one did not work very well. I mean, they did get to the foul line 25 out of 30, so that was really the only source of consistent offense for them. Really a struggle for them offensively, and that's always going to be their weakness. You know, they just don't have guys who are great passers. George can get it going at times, but is not usually going to be the linchpin of an efficient offense all by himself, even when he himself is scoring efficiently. So I don't know. Anything else you had in terms of notes on this one?
Not really. I spent a portion of this thing. You just mentioned the idea of them creating their offense about if, and I'm not saying they will, but if Indiana won this series, I think they would have a lot of trouble with whoever was on the other side of it, just because that issues of shot creation and all that stuff are going to be exacerbated by their talent at a couple of different positions. A
couple other notes that I had. Valanciunas, we noted, was great. He had 5 offensive rebounds. Lowry, a lot of his 8 first half assists came to Valanciunas. Valanciunas had 19 of his 23 points in the first half, many of them off of pick and roll finishes. Valanciunas doesn't kind of fit the mold of a great pick and roll player. You know, he's kind of slow. He's got great length, but, you know, he's not going to get up for huge dunks or come down the lane and take off from the dotted line. But he has excellent hands and, you know, just has a good knack for kind of finding angles on the pick and roll. And he was great at that in the first half, because you'll remember in game one, a lot of times guys like Lowry and DeRozan would drive, and then the rim protector, Mahimi or Turner, would be there, and they just, you know, didn't have a play. But Lowry was able to just keep working it around, keep his dribble alive, and then eventually find that passing angle to Valanciunas. I thought that was definitely pretty excellent, and Valanciunas has been quite outstanding so far in the series. Really the first time he's been able to assert himself in these last few playoffs for Toronto.
And as you mentioned, and as I saw way back in 2009, Monte Ellis help defender is not the greatest experience in the world.
Yeah, that's true. And it's one of the things that you forget about with someone like Ellis, as especially when it's the shooting guard, is, you know, if you're running a pick and roll, whoever the backside wing is, it's his responsibility to crash in. And, you know, sometimes you'll have to box out whoever the roll man is. Sometimes you'll have to get in front of him. And Ellis just, you know, already has some physical disadvantages. He's got a really small wingspan, and he's not a guy who really competes that hard on the defensive end. He's not strong enough to deal with bigs. He doesn't have the length really to contest anybody at the rim. And so you're giving something up defensively when you play him, not to mention some of his on-ball adventures. But that aspect, he just is not really able to be a presence at all when he's coming over to crash into the lane on the weak side. And they gave up a bunch of buckets when he just wasn't able to get into position on those plays.
Yep, don't really have anything to add.
One of the transitions when I stopped being a lawyer was I realized that I am now a small business owner and I needed some business cards. Best place to get that? Vistaprint.com, currently offering you 500 business cards for just $99 using my promo code CAPSPACE at checkout. Please use that code. That is a way to let them know that you came from us. And Vistaprint is fantastic for small business owners. They offer tons of custom products for home and office needs, not just business cards, but postcards, flyers, banners, t-shirts, coffee mugs, whatever you need done. You can customize the text, colors, backsides, anything else that you want on any of those products. They have thousands of industry-specific templates as well. You can upload your logo, or you can use their custom design services to help you design the perfect product to promote your business. So you can get 500 business cards as a starter for just $9.99 using my code CAPSPACE at checkout. It's 50% savings over the regular site pricing, and they're really, really easy to customize. So go to Vistaprint.com, design your custom business cards, enter that CAPSPACE code at checkout, and you'll get yourself some awesome business cards for an unbeatable price. Golden State and Houston. We'll get to the Steph Curry situation in a little bit at the end of this, because I do have some interesting thoughts there, I hope. But let's talk about the game first. Steph did not play. And what were your initial thoughts on how this one went?
This is sort of a parallel to the Dallas OKC game, in that, except that I kind of feel the reverse. So I don't want to short shrift the Warriors in terms of, you know, that they tried hard and they played hard and they did some nice things defensively. But Houston was just such a massive disappointment for me in this game, especially defensively.
I would say they were bad. I wouldn't say they were a disappointment, just because I haven't seen anything from them this year to indicate that they would be good on defense. You know, I mean, in this game, at least they didn't give up like a crap load of backdoors. I don't think they even gave up any backdoors. That was what killed them in that other game that they played on New Year's against the Warriors without Steph in Houston. But yeah, the defensive effort was not really good enough. The Warriors' offensive rebounding in the first half really killed them. They got out in transition quite a bit, turned the ball over in the first half. I mean, giving up 66 points in the first half on 50 possessions to a Warriors team without Steph, you know, that's just nowhere near good enough. you know, they started Demo. That didn't really seem to work that well. The plan was to have Demo just switch out onto everything, and, you know, I don't think that really worked particularly well. And then Dwight Howard had a somnambulant first half.
He really did, and a lot of things contributed to something that was notable for me as somebody who's, you know, covered this team, is that Klay Thompson got to the line a lot, and some of it was at the end, but he's at a career high both in terms of makes and attempts, and he's a guy who's kind of notorious for not getting to the line a ton. You know, he does get there from time to time, and so when he's the aggressor in that way, and some of that is credit to him because Curry was out, but you can do other things. Like, he was taking some tough shots, but they were just bailing him out more than a few times.
34 points for Thompson. He was 8 of 20 for the field, 3 of 8 from 3, and a plus 16. Also had 5 assists, which is not something that you see a ton from him. And yeah, he was, with the Rockets, all of the switching that they were doing, a lot of the plays that he had were just kind of driving past guys who had switched onto him, you know, guys like Muddy Unis, Harden. They eventually ended up putting Harden on Draymond Green once he got into foul trouble. Two other guys who deserve credit for Golden State as well. One was Iguodala, who hit 4 threes in a row in the first half. It was just on fire. He had getting 18 points out of him. And he had solid defense on James Harden, too, when he wasn't reaching in. And he played 33 minutes, which is more than he normally plays. He was fantastic.
And also, Sean Livingston, I think, deserves a ton of credit for being such a steady hand and for doing a nice job and for giving another nice term for James Harden, the guy who shows the candy. I just loved that. So there's a visual of it with Kerr, because basically one of the storylines of this game is that in the first half, the Warriors did what they did not do in the first game, which was they kept on reaching. And so the line that Kerr relayed that Livingston says is that Harden is the guy who shows the candy, so you reach for the candy and then you get called for the foul. And I just love that. That and of course Slip and Jimmy.
Yeah, Slip and Jimmy. I mean, for those of you who don't remember this one, my girlfriend came up with this one, that that's a character from Better Call Saul, who basically was would pretend to like get hit by cars and then sue people. So that was a fantastic game. And Slip and Jimmy was in full effect in the first half. He was 2 out of 8 for 16 points in the first half, and had, I think, 15 free throw attempts, I want to say, in the first half. Maybe it was 13. 3 of those were 3 shot fouls, where guys just reached in, and another one was just a kind of a bogus reach in by Iguodala. So it must have been really frustrating for Steve Kerr that absolutely none of the fouls that Harden had were actually like legitimate. All right, he really beat us and like got to the rim and we just fouled him, you know, trying to contest. It was just like kind of mental errors of reaching in and then just like BS fouls. It is a little annoying to me that it seems like the league is going in the direction where it's easier to get a foul call on the perimeter where you're just selling the contact and like doing a motion that's not even necessarily a shooting motion, like through guys' arms, and like at the rim you can't get a call anymore, you know, even when there's a ton of contact. I mean, I get verticality, I'm okay with that, but you know, I feel like guys are kind of, you know, what a foul is kind of being perverted slightly. What do you think of that?
I think there's definitely something to that. And the other challenge with it is when you're dealing with, I guess you could call it more skilled guys, is that I think they're going to become, if it continues to be officiated this way, they're going to become more and more adept at manufacturing, you know, what is necessary to do it. And we'll see if it changes the way it's officiated. But there are some lingering effects and kind of that can be exaggerated and worsened if this continues.
Yeah, I think that's maybe a fair way to look at it. A couple other notes here we can just go through. Andrew Bogut was fantastic. 5 out of 6 from the field. Got on the offensive glass for 5 offensive rebounds. A lot of those were tip-ins. 3 block shots as well. Really just a wonderful game for him. Led the Warriors in plus-minus with plus 23. And really the only time the Rockets really get going was when he was out of the game. He really, I thought, dominated Dwight Howard. I tweeted during the first half that he's officially a bad defender. He picked it up a little bit in the second half, but, you know, he's almost like Hassan Whiteside these days. He used to be characterized by great mobility out in the perimeter, and now, you know, you set a screen with his man, and he's just not going to get out there. There's a ton of times where Klay Thompson would just get a screen and be wide open, and Howard just wouldn't even move. You know, they'd give up a 3.
Yeah, it's definitely concerning. And I mean, we talked about it, just the two of us sitting next to each other during the game, is that you're in a weird place with him if you're a team that wants to get better. And of course, centers, especially centers that can block shots, are always going to be valuable, because you want to, the idea of surplus value is important. You know, you want to be somebody who's getting benefit in the early years because you expect that he'll go downhill. So figuring out a price for him is substantially harder now than I think we expected and hoped, because you always want everybody to do well. Hoped, let's say, a year ago this time.
You know, it really is a shame to me that Howard has had such a decline. And, it's not unexpected for a guy relying on athleticism, turning 30, essentially, come with back and knee issues. But, I was just watching some old highlights of him on a whim a couple of days ago, and he was just used to be so incredible. And the fact that he's had all this drama and now has kind of fallen out of his prime maybe a little bit more quickly than you would have hoped, I hope that doesn't obscure what an unbelievable player he was for about 5 years in Orlando. Like, that should not be forgotten. He was just, the best defensive player in the league for 3 or 4 years, and, maybe the best pick and roll big man in the league, and actually like a pretty good post threat against most guys as well. And now, pretty much all of that appears to be gone. It's just kind of too bad. Any other thoughts you had on this one?
No, I mean, well of course we're going to talk about Curry. And one thing that was disconcerting, another Bruin that is not having a great playoff so far, Ariza, he's doing all right. It's not like he's been this albatross out there, but he just hasn't made the consistent defensive impact that he was known for, particularly earlier in his career, most notably with the Lakers.
Yeah, he didn't get a lot of help on Clay. There's been times when he's actually shut him down, but with all the switching, a lot of those buckets were not necessarily at his expense. He has not been shooting the ball particularly well. His transition defense, was really disappointing. I mean, there's one play where, it was Clay basically had a one-on-one after a steal going into the front court, and Harrison Barnes and Ariza were both on the opposite baseline. Barnes just sprinted down, Ariza jogged down, and Barnes got an easy offensive rebound because of that. Those are a lot of the effort plays. And then the other thing I would say, too, is, this has been a problem for Houston forever, going back to last year's Western Conference Finals against this team. Only 270 passes. There just have no movement at all offensively. Like, there are plays where, for example, Harden would ISO on one side of the floor. Andrew Bogut came over to double, and just they didn't have the spacing. They didn't have the movement. There are plenty of pick and roll plays where it was just the three other guys who weren't involved in the pick and roll just like literally never moved the entire possession. Houston's offense does not move the ball enough, does not have the spacing enough to really, even when Harden has an okay game like he did in this one, 28 points and 11 assists, and, with the free throws, relatively efficient. It's just their offense is not been good enough in this series, not to mention their defense.
Oh, one other thing. While I am thrilled that he's back in the league and that he had a nice little close after he came back from China, Michael Beasley, I don't think you can really play him much in the playoffs because he's so easily exposed on defense.
Yeah, that's true. Anytime he was on someone like Barnes or even Draymond Green, like it would just be a blow-by. And that's really – Harden also gave up a couple of blow-bys, too. I thought he was in foul trouble. That might have been a little bit of the problem. And I thought Bickerstaff did well to just leave him in with three fouls. When you're the underdog in the series, you need to do that in the second quarter. And that kind of helped them, he had a lot of his sort of foul drawing there, and it helped them stay kind of in the game. But Harden, he'd give up a blow by, and then he'd look back at Howard like, hey, how come you didn't get over there? And yeah, Howard probably should get there. But when you're giving up a blow by, you sure as hell make it a lot harder. You need to at least like make the guy like cross you over, or like, this was just like turn and face from 17, straight line drive right to the rim for a dunk, So it was, he gave up two plays like that, one to Green and one to Barnes. And looking back at your big man after you perform absolutely as badly as possible as you can on a given defensive possession, not really a great look.
Yeah, and one other thing, we talked about it after game one, is I want to see, especially if game three goes badly for them, whether J.B. Bickerstaff will actually start playing their young guys. Clint Capella played 6 minutes in this game. K.J. McDaniels played one garbage minute.
Yeah, I thought K.J. actually was okay in the first game.
So did I.
I'm not sure what he did to not get any playing time at all. At least he's someone who's going to go hard, and give you some athleticism, give you some effort plays. Houston just, I can't really think of very many effort plays that they had in this one. Another thing, too, before we get to the Steph injury, I'm just really happy for Sean Livingston to be able to start a playoff game, play as well as he did, 7-9 from the field, 16 points, had some really nice assists as well. And, for a guy who had that catastrophic knee injury that everyone knows about, just for at least to play one game as the starting point guard on a contender, like that's like what he was born to do, you know, coming out of Peoria Central High School in Illinois in 2004, and that he was kind of robbed of that destiny. The fact that he actually got to do that in front of a great crowd and lead a great team like this, I was really happy for him.
Yeah, it was a really nice moment, and I think at moments I think that his story's been told a lot, and then in other moments I think that basketball fans in general might underappreciate how amazing it is. Just like for the, I think the same thing sometimes about Vince Carter, about how Vince has reinvented himself and really done it. And of course, he had a very different set of circumstances. He just got older, unlike Livingston, whose knee exploded. But it's so much work to be able to reach that level and to be able to thrive at something other than your physical prime. And I think the players that do that are definitely worthy of admiration and appreciation when we get the chance to do so.
Let's get to Steph. The scene pregame was a little surreal. Steve Kerr, you know, this is kind of what happens. 5:45, the home coach will talk, you know, an hour and 45 minutes before game time. And he said, we don't know yet with Steph. We're going to have him warm up. That had been the party line the whole time. And sometimes they've just BS'd on that and Steph hasn't warmed up and they just, you know, knew he was going to be out. This didn't seem like necessarily one of those times because Steph actually went through his warm up. He starts with, you know, the dribbling with two balls for a couple of minutes. Then he does some kind of very like, you know, hooks and floaters off of 1 foot. And then we'll take a few shots from the baseline, which he was draining. And then he tried to make his first move where he actually really made a cut. And when he made that first move, you know, Bruce Frazier is the coach that works him out, Coach Q. And he looked over at him after making that first move, trying to push off his right foot, slammed the ball down, and walked off the floor, basically. And so it was very clear that he was not going to be playing after that happened.
Yeah, it definitely was. And it did take some of the air. Well, actually, there weren't a ton of people in the building yet because it was so early, but it did take some of the air out of it. And
Yeah, crowd was still great, though, during the game.
Oh, fabulous. I think the term I used early on was defiant. You know, that it was the crowd that really took pride in what their team was doing. And that's great. You know, that's kind of what you want to – it's not kind of. It's exactly what you want a crowd to do. But, yeah, it is – something that the Warriors now, though, have the luxury of being able to be patient, and they can have this long-term vision, which is very unusual when you're in the playoffs, because usually you have to think about that, you know, the immediacy, the urgency, and they don't have to have urgency right now.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit more concerned about Steph now than I was earlier. It was initially, it's been characterized this whole time as an ankle injury. The official diagnosis was a tweaked ankle. And it looked like when he was on the bench, they were kind of rubbing like the outside of his foot, like it might be his ankle, but I didn't really see on the video like any kind of injury mechanism. Usually you'll see like an inversion where your ankle will twist underneath you. I didn't really see that. And then in the locker room after the game on Sunday, it wasn't really swollen at all. So it kind of looked more to me like it might be his foot. I was thinking that even before then. And then Kerr, I don't know whether he slipped up or what, but he actually referred to it as his foot in the post-game press conference. And then he was asked about it again. He's like, oh, I don't know, foot, ankle. It's all the same thing. I'm not really sure what it is, you know. But it wouldn't surprise me if it was his foot, because when you kind of sprain your foot, I don't know if that's what it is or whatever, you know, it's not really as apparent just watching. So I've actually had that injury before, so I kind of know that. But it's, you know, it just kind of happens without anything really like, you know, that acute looking. So I don't know. I think the ankle sprain, Steph had said, well, you know, it's nowhere near as bad as the OKC one. Well, the OKC one, he wasn't limping around right afterward the way he could, and he couldn't even move when he tried to go back in the game. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying like, oh, this is going to be a disaster or anything, but I'm like a little bit more worried about it. And Kerr did not sound like particularly optimistic about him going forward either.
He didn't. And I thought we both kind of did, just with the way he reacted. I mean, I've seen, sadly enough, a fair amount of Stephen Curry ankle sprains, and it didn't seem like those. And so I actually thought it was a foot thing the entire rest of that game. And then when they said it was an ankle, I'm like, oh, that's kind of weird. And then, and of course, that, and for a lot of people, that scared them more than a foot thing. But for me, the foot is a lot scarier, just because I feel, from, obviously, I'm not a doctor or anything like that, it seems to me like it's harder to manage in that sense.
Yeah, so I don't know. We don't know what it really is. Who knows? Maybe he'll play on Thursday. He's got 2 days. you know, maybe they'll say, hey, we'll just try and win game three against a demoralized Rockets team. Maybe we can just completely close out the series without Steph, and he'll have a whole 2 weeks, essentially, to rest. So it's not time to panic yet or anything, but, you know, this deserves to be monitored. Like, I don't think it's a given that he's just going to be back right away. Maybe it will be, but there seems to be a little bit more here than maybe people have been letting on.
Yeah, I think it's something worth watching, especially considering he's the reigning and going to be next MVP of the league. So and it was great that they won this game, but what I was driving back and I was thinking, you know, they're not going to be able to pull off a game like they did here, even against the Clippers, much less the Spurs or the Thunder.
Yeah, you know, I did think the Rockets were 10 out of 25 on threes, and they were 26 of 33 from the line. You know, I think this was kind of in some ways the Rockets' best chance, even when you don't consider that, you know, Steph didn't play. So I don't know. I mean, I think they actually have at least a 50% chance, if not more, of winning game three, even without Steph. And the defense with Livingston is even better, if anything, without Steph. So, and I still don't think that Houston necessarily can score on these guys. So, you know, in the immediate term, not really a concern that much, but we'll see what ends up happening. Anything to plug before we go?
Not yet. Have a couple things in the works, though. They'll be coming out soon.
And don't forget to check out our sponsors, MeUndies, using that MeUndies.com/capspace vanity URL. And, of course, Vistaprint, using the familiar capspace code. Talk to you all next time.